Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to start the program by talking with you about cervical cancer. If you find it early, it can be found early and sometimes even be prevented entirely, but it's a cancer that affects thousands of women every year, and minority women are most likely to be or more likely to be diagnosed with the disease. And that's according to our guest, who's done a lot of research on this subject. Dr. Laurel Rice is chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, professor in the Division of Gynecology Oncology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and a member of the UW Carbone Cancer Center. So we'll be talking with her and taking your questions as well about cervical cancer. I hope you'll join us. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And Dr. Laurel Rice, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, Larry, thank you for having me.
First off, how common is cervical cancer in the U.S. and in Wisconsin?
Well, the incidence in the United States overall is about 8.1 women per 100,000. And in Wisconsin, it's a little bit less than that. It's about 6.5. Now, the story is much different for African American women, where the incidence in the United States is about 9.2, and the incidence in Wisconsin is about 9.8. I think it's important to note, since the 1970s, the incidence of cervical cancer in the United States has decreased by 75%.
Wow.
Yeah, because of pap smear screening. So in the U.S., it's the 14th most common cancer that affects women. But worldwide, it's number three because of lack of screening in underserved countries.
Yeah, a lot of your research focuses on how cervical cancer disproportionately affects minority women. Can you give us, talk a little bit more about what's going on here? You wonder why?
Well, it's multifactorial, but it's definitely a fact that African women and Hispanic women are more commonly diagnosed with cancer and more commonly die of that cancer once they are diagnosed. I think the factors that play into that are multifold. The first thing to think about is the fact that this is a preventable cancer. We know that women who are getting their pap smears can reduce the incidence of cervical cancer, their incidence, by about 94%.
Wow.
And half of the cancer cases diagnosed in the United States are in women who have never had pap smear screening. So from the get-go, you can see that for a cancer that's preventable, women of color particularly are underserved. And it's not just ethnicity and race. It's lower socioeconomic class. It's lower educational level. There are several other things besides race that play into it. But my research focus has been on health disparity as it relates to race.
So what makes this cancer, or is there anything in particular that makes this cancer unique? It's good to know that it's preventable, or at least it can be cured.
Well, there are some unique factors, Larry. First of all, about 99% of cases of cervical cancer are related to a virus, human papillomavirus, which is sexually transmitted. So right from the get-go, we know the cause of cervical cancer. And we also know that besides screening, which really decreases the incidence of this cancer for all women, there is also a prevention strategy, namely HPV vaccination. In 2006, about then, the FDA approved this vaccine for women, girls, starting at age 9, and 3 to 4 years later approved it for men or boys, and the data is compelling that you can decrease the types of HPV that are associated with cervical cancer or penile cancer. So I think what's important to note about the HPV vaccine is, you know, while the goal for vaccination in the appropriate age groups is 100%, we should be vaccinating all men and women, the actual vaccination rate in the United States is about 40%. About 40% of the individuals who should be getting vaccines or vaccination against this virus are receiving it. Now, it's worth noting that in Australia, Western Europe, HPV vaccination rates approach 90%.
Yeah.
So in the United States, we're behind the eight ball in screening and prevention of cervical cancer. My article focused on the treatment of cancer when it's diagnosed. But those other two factors, screening and prevention, are very important.
I would certainly think so. And is typically, are these shots covered by insurance? Or if not, what kinds of costs?
Yes, they typically are covered by insurance. And so that's a very good question. And insurance companies usually do cover it. And it's usually, the important thing is that initially it was a three-dose regimen, and now the data supports that, you know, adequate vaccination can occur with two treatments.
Dr. Laurel Rice, our guest today, talking with her about cervical cancer. It affects thousands of women every year, and some are at a much higher risk of getting that disease than others. So we're talking about that with her, and certainly ready and able to answer your questions. If you would like to join in, I hope you do. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Maybe you've had a loved one who had cervical cancer diagnosis. Maybe you have some other questions. I hope you'll join in. We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line but had a question for you. She said her doctor said she no longer had to have pap smears because she wasn't sexually active and as a result wasn't a risk for cervical cancer. She wanted to know if that advice is correct.
Larry, that's a very good question. And it's important to know that on a somewhat regular basis, meaning every 2 to 3 years, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force provides the country with their recommendations on cancer screening in general, but most certainly cervical cancer screening. Most recently, that organization recommended against screening for cervical cancer in women younger than age 21 years. They make the important point that pre-cancer or cancer of the cervix is very rare under the age of 20. They recommend against screening for cervical cancer with HPV testing alone or in combination with pap smear screening in women under the age of 30. Now, for women between the ages of 21 and 65, the recommendation is every 3 years, and that recommendation can change based on what the woman's history of pap smear screening is. For example, if she's had an abnormal pap smear, she'll need to speak with her gynecologist more specifically about the recommendations. And then for women older than age 65 who have had adequate prior screening and are not otherwise at high risk for cervical cancer, screening can stop. So there are a subset of women that don't need to have pap smear screening, but the important thing is defining high risk.
Yeah.
And that requires careful discussion with one's physician. Things like immunosuppression, steroids, previously abnormal pap smear. There are some things that change those recommendations for one or a specific woman.
Yeah. Marie and Merrill has something that I think relates to this, so let's go there. Hi, Marie. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Part of what I was asking about, Doctor just addressed, I believe. However, I'm specifically, I'm an old nurse practitioner, and so I go back to the 70s with recommendations up and down and off and on. And could you explain, you know, why they're not doing as many pap smears on teenagers? You know, say they come in for contraception to a family planning or Planned Parenthood, whatever, or even the physician's office, as we used to. And I'm very familiar with the evolution of the sophistication of pap smears and how they've changed, but that's just really...
Well, I think that's a very good question. And, of course, if a young teenager is sexually active, screening before the age of 21 years is appropriate. I think the point that the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force is taking is that routine screening before the age of 21 is not cost-effective. And they've done studies that are very involved with thousands and thousands of patients. But I think that, again, part of this is, you know, is the global recommendations and the specific. For example, if a 17-year-old comes in with genital warts, that's a patient who should have a pap smear. So as much as, and it's similar to mammography, the USPSTF wants to set up, you know, very straightforward guidelines. But at the same time, as a physician, I'd like to make note of the fact that important to think about the individual patient as well.
Right. I guess I just think, you know, the term cost-effective has been around for a long time, and to me, cost-effective versus good medical practice or gynecological practice are two different things. I used to tell the physician that I was in a team practice with that all it's going to take is one Cancer Society official's wife, daughter, mother, sister, whatever, to come down with cervical cancer, and her last pap was, and I've seen this myself, it's rare, one was 3 years the last pap, she ended up dying, and one was 10 years. But I really think, and the mammography is a similar issue. I think cost-effective is a loosely used term that applies to statistics, but when it comes down to the patient or...
I think it's a complicated topic. And as a physician who has cared for women with cervical cancer for years, because I am a gynecologic oncologist, my gut agrees with you, of course. I think the data, and it's not just cost-effective part of it, which I agree with you, is a word that's almost got a negative connotation for those of us taking care of patients. But the data is compelling from a societal population point of view. And the point I'd like to highlight again is that half of the women diagnosed with cervical cancer have never had a pap smear.
Yeah, that's really a shame. Marie, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Want to get some others a chance to join in. Let's go to Jim and Eau Claire next. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment about the HPV immunization. I'm a pediatrician who's been in practice a long time and hopefully can give that to my patients every time I can get people to agree to it. But it's a two-dose series in the vaccine if the patient starts before they're 15 years old. That was a recent change. So if they receive their vaccine, start receiving their vaccine after age 15, they still need three doses. And I just wanted to...
Jim, thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Visiting today with Dr. Laurel Rice from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Talking cervical cancer today with Dr. Laurel Rice, chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She's also a member of the UW Carbone Cancer Center. It's great to have her along as we visit about cervical cancer with her, and we have many callers online, so I want to go right back to the phones. And Ann in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. First of all, I want to express my gratitude for Planned Parenthood for providing me with essential services when I lived under the poverty line for a decade. They're there for women that hopefully can prevent these kind of issues. But my question today is there any link with cervical cancer and endometrial cancer and ovarian cancer and breast cancer, and is there a genetic predisposition?
Very good question. And cervical cancer is very different than those cancers because there is no genetic link.
Oh.
It is purely related to HPV exposure. And there's one notable exception. There used to be a drug 40 or 50 years ago called diethylstilbestrol, DES, which was used to help prevent miscarriages, which increased a certain kind of cervical cancer, but again, not inherited. Now, the one caveat, because I'm a GYN oncologist, that's important to remember is sometimes endometrial cancer can spread to the cervix. But in that situation, it's still considered endometrial cancer, but metastatic to the cervix. But otherwise, breast, ovary, endometrial, all of which have a significant inherited risk in some circumstances. It's just not the same for cervical cancer.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Alicia in Milwaukee next. Hi, Alicia.
Good morning. I am a part of an organization in Milwaukee called the Green City Medical Society, and we discuss issues of healthcare disparities, such as those that exist amongst African American and Hispanic women, something like this issue today. So I was just wondering, to what does Dr. Rice attribute this disparity in diagnosis and treatment of cervical cancer, and what has her research shown could be helpful with respect to closing that disparity?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very important question. I think when it comes to disparity in cervical cancer, it's like other health conditions, such as maternal mortality rate, infant mortality rate. Much of this is based on sociodemographic and healthcare access characteristics. If half of the women with cervical cancer have never had a pap smear, that speaks to the issue of access. This is a preventable cancer. So I think the disparity that we're seeing in terms of race is partly attributable to access, either things like, you know, health insurance, finances, transportation. There's a plethora of specifics related to access. And the same with sociodemographic. I think 30 or 40 years ago, you know, there was less knowledge about these issues being important. And then, of course, the second part of your question is so important, what to do. My research, because I'm a cancer doctor, not a primary care doctor, has been focused on the treatment of cervical cancer and that disparity. What I think would be one way to more clearly define why this happens is to take a cancer center such as the Carbone Cancer Center or any other cancer center and prospectively look and study all women coming in with cervical cancer, and what are the roadblocks to them getting guideline care? The treatment for cervical cancer, as I outlined in my paper, is very straightforward. It involves, and this is advanced cervical cancer, meaning non-operable. It involves radiation therapy, both external beam and local radiation therapy plus chemotherapy. Studying prospectively why women don't get that would be one way to really drill down and better answer the question. The statistics are appalling. So I think your question is a really good one.
Yeah. And your paper, by the way, we have it up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show. If anybody wants to go to that site, you can read the entire paper. Alicia, does that help? Or does that answer your question?
Yes, that's very helpful. And are there any efforts for that type of work to be done?
It's interesting. This paper was published in just a few months ago, and Dr. Howard Bailey is the chief of our cancer center here, a committed physician and investigator, and he and I are working on developing a platform to do just this at the Carbone Cancer Center. I do think that part of the issue is that if you want to look at national statistics, which I did in this paper with 16,000 women, it won't be enough to just have one cancer center in Wisconsin involved in this kind of study because, of course, the United States is such a diverse place.
Yeah.
We'd need to have Los Angeles, New York, bigger cities, and have a good cross-section of the country.
Yeah.
Can Cancer Society assist you in something like that?
You know, I think so. It would involve writing a grant and applying for funds. And I know that Dr. Bailey and myself are both prepared to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Yes.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. Let's turn to Larry in Oshkosh next. Hi, Larry. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having this program. I'm concerned about what happens after treatment. If treatment has been relatively successful and laser treatment has been used and so forth, what does the data show, doctor, with regard to prognosis? What's the general outcome as far as we know at this particular point in time?
Yeah, so the success rate of treatment, really, we're talking about.
Exactly.
Larry, very good question. And let me preface my comments about cervical cancer with the treatment of cervical dysplasia or precancer. If we are able to treat precancer with laser or excision prior to the actual diagnosis of cervical cancer, then the patient won't even get cervical cancer. That's why screening and prevention are so important, because really, once we have an abnormal pap smear and we're able to treat a woman, we can prevent this cancer. But once a woman is diagnosed with cervical cancer, her survival very much depends on the stage. For example, if someone is diagnosed with in situ carcinoma, the beginning stages, we can cure that with almost 100% certainty. If someone presents with stage 4 cervical cancer, their survival rate is about 10%.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's a very good question.
Timing is everything. Intervening on a particular stage.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Is the key to this. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Larry. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call if you have a question or an experience to share as we visit about cervical cancer with Dr. Laurel Rice from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Jillian in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for listening to me. I was also a person with cervical cancer. I had the treatment, which was very simple, and I never developed it. My question is, far better to screen and prevent than to be giving vaccines to young women. And that's a very high-profit vaccine for the vaccine industry. Far better to use the funds to screen and prevent. And when you talk about how many women get cervical cancer because they're not screened, they're the people you need to be finding and screening.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Jillian. Dr. Rice, comment?
Yeah. I think that the point you're making is a really good one. If we could screen with pap smear the women who should be getting screened, we could significantly decrease the incidence of cervical cancer. I think the issue with HPV vaccination, it has been studied extensively and published upon. I do think that it decreases the incidence of dysplasia in women and penile warts in men. I actually am a fan of taking both approaches because taking care of women with cervical cancer, recognizing that it could be prevented, is just painful.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling, Jillian. Appreciate your call. Yeah, and as a parent, I thought, well, to me this seemed like almost a no-brainer in some ways to have a daughter have those vaccines.
Well, I have two children, and both of them, one girl and one boy, and I most certainly had both of them vaccinated.
Yeah, understood. But I do take Jillian's point. If there's a significant cost associated with it, now, if you don't have insurance, I don't know what it would cost.
Yeah. I'm not sure the actual amount. I think it's expensive. Jillian, your point's well taken.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for calling. Robin in Okano Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Robin.
Hi. I was wondering if you had a hysterectomy other than your ovaries. I mean, I've had everything removed other than my ovaries. Do you still have to have a pap test done?
No. The recommendation is if you've had a hysterectomy with no history of dysplasia, either vaginal or vulvar in the last 3 years, and it depends, again, on the age a little bit. The recommendation is that no. Now, the important thing to remember is that HPV affects the entire lower genital tract, including the vagina, the vulva, the anus. So it kind of depends on what the indications for the hysterectomy were. For example, if one was having a hysterectomy for very early stage cancer, then that would be different than saying having a hysterectomy for fibroids or something like that.
Yes, and that's what it was for.
Yeah. No, I think depending on your previous history of pap smear screening, et cetera, and this is a topic to discuss with your physician because, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the recommendations are, it's not one bullet point. There are multiple things to consider. But
okay.
Good question.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Cindy in Mount Horeb, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Thank you for having this topic on.
Sure.
I was wondering if your guest could comment on, I realizing that cervical cancer is obviously a woman's thing, but due to its HPV associated cause, could you speak about the role of young men in getting vaccinated for themselves and for the partners in their life as well, please?
Yes, and that's a great question. About 4 to 5 years after the HPV vaccine was approved for women, it was approved for men. And the reason is, obviously, you're not going to screen for cervical cancer in a man, but the incidence of penile warts. So, of course, in that it's a sexually transmitted disease, it affects both men and women. I think the other important point is the incidence of oropharyngeal cancer associated with HPV has gone up significantly in the last 20 years. So the HPV vaccination also works against HPV in that site, meaning oropharyngeal, meaning mouth,
yeah.
Throat and mouth. I think that there have been some studies, because part of this is decreasing the HPV, the virus, in the population at large. And by doing that, you can, it's kind of an additive effect. So I like your question very much. As I stated a few minutes ago, I did have my son vaccinated.
Yeah, we've encouraged our sons as well.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the topic.
Thank you for the question.
Thanks very much for calling. And again, you can join us. Dr. Laurel Rice, our guest, chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. She's a professor in the Division of Gynecology and Oncology at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and a member of the UW Carbone Cancer Center. And we'll take some more calls here. Ivy in Evansville, we'll go right to you. Ivy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I know someone who got the vaccination as a teenager before they were sexually active, and then later HPV turned up on their screening. And I was wondering if there's different kinds, or if the vaccine, you might end up getting it, but the vaccine helps preventing it from, I don't know, staying in your body. I mean, fights it.
Yes. Oh, I really like this question.
Thank you.
I think the first thing to realize is the HPV vaccine, there is a couple on the market. One is against two types of HPV. One is against 4, and one is against 9. There are about 40 to 50 strains of HPV that affect the cervix, and there are certain types that are more associated with cervical cancer. They're called high-risk types of HPV, and that's where the vaccine focuses. So you, depending on what type of HPV, it could be a type that isn't covered by the vaccine but is very low risk of being associated with cervical cancer. Or, of course, the vaccine is not perfect, which is why if a woman gets a vaccine, they still need pap smears.
Oh.
Right. So it's great, but it's not 100%. And the information regarding the type of HPV strain is very important.
No.
Julie and Madison, will turn to you next. Hi, Julie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, sure. I just have a question about male circumcision, how this would enter into the HPV status. You talked about penile warts, but would the fact that the male's been circumcised or not, does that
have an impact?
Absolute risk factor, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not sure.
Huh?
That's a question that I don't know the answer to.
I'm a nurse, and we worked, it was always one of the things, you know, for children or babies to be circumcised when they were born, and it was kind of a thing, you know, pediatricians would say, oh, that's hogwash, but that it would cut down the risk of cervical cancer if the baby boys were circumcised.
You know, I really should know the answer to that, and I don't.
Oh.
So there you have it.
Well. Something to look into, Dr. Rice. Oh,
but okay. Well, thank you much anyway.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Oh, man. Talk a little more about your research and the research that's going on relating to cervical cancer within the your department and the UW Carbone Cancer Center.
Well, I think there's a lot going on at UW and the Carbone Cancer Center. There are a group of investigators, physicians, looking at how to decrease the risk of developing this kind of cancer, both in the United States and in other countries where the incidence is much higher. Like I mentioned at the beginning, Larry, it's the third most common cancer affecting women worldwide. And so there's a lot of research going, both in the basic science arena as well as in clinical trials. For me, my work has focused primarily on large databases to better understand what affects the treatment. And the paper that we're talking about here today best represents the work that I'm involved with. I think that the disparity exists. I think one of the things that we're also focusing on in the department is health literacy and understanding HPV vaccination. That's another area of research for us. Because, and this is now primarily in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, we have been looking at HPV vaccination throughout the UW system. And what we've learned is that there are many patients that don't fully understand why they should be vaccinated. And also important to note, in that 9 to 12-year-olds are the primary target, pediatricians and family medicine doctors are very important in increasing the vaccination rate here in Dane County and throughout the United States. So in terms of the research that's being done, The Department of OBGYN is looking at an educational platform for all patients that's understandable and presents the data in a way that folks can really understand.
It's I'm thinking about worldwide. I would guess, you know, in some countries, less developed countries than ours, the opportunities for pap smears and so forth is much less, which is probably why there are more issues in some of those other countries.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. And it's very hard, I mean, because worldwide, the absolute number of cases of cervical cancer is about 500,000. And 275,000 women die of the disease worldwide. And again, the very hard thing about this is that it's very preventable.
Yeah.
And,
Sort of to conclude, what's your advice to anyone listening today?
My advice is to have a conversation with your physician regarding what your specific risk factors are so that you can have the appropriate pap smear screening interval. And then, you know, depending on your age, and I'm thinking there's not many 9-year-olds listening to this radio station, I'm thinking that another question is the HPV vaccination, either for oneself or one's children.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Dr. Rice, to have a chance to speak with you today about cervical cancer, and I hope we have a chance to visit again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Have a good day, Larry.
You as well. Dr. Laurel Rice, Chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Professor in the Division of Gynecology Oncology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and a member of the Carbone Cancer Center. It's an important discussion, I think, and it was great to have her with us today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.